It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. In 2001, my guest, California Congresswoman Barbara Lee, became famous for casting the lone vote against authorization of force following the September 11th attacks. Tonight, Barbara Lee is being honored as the 43rd Thomas Merton Center awardee for her courage in standing as a lone voice for human rights and human dignity. She's written a book called Renegade for Peace and Justice, and she is in Pittsburgh to accept the Merton Award this evening at the Sheridan Station Square Hotel. She joins us now in studio. Congresswoman Lee, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
My pleasure. Really happy to be here.
And you can join the conversation at 412-246-2002. That's 412-246-2002. Email is essspgh@wesa.fm and on Twitter at essspgh. Again, the number 412-246-2002. Congresswoman Lee, let's go back to 2001, after the September 11th attacks, when you were the lone member of either chamber of Congress to vote against the authorization for the use of military force. Why did you vote that way?
First, that was a difficult time. It was a very sad time, emotional time, and of course we were all angry, as I was. My chief of staff, his cousin was a flight attendant on Flight 93. So it was a very difficult moment for the country. And it was a moment that I believed we needed to respond appropriately. I wasn't looking through the world through rose-colored glasses. I knew we had to take some action. But I also knew that 3 days after this horrific attack was not the time to do that. And I also knew, when I read the resolution that was brought before us, that we could not give then-President Bush, nor any subsequent president, a blank check to use force. And that resolution was so broad, it was so nonspecific, until I knew then, as I still maintain, and the Congressional Research Service has done an unclassified report showing it's been used over 30-some times in Yemen, Somalia, and parts of the world for different types of actions that are non-related to 9/11, but it was a blank check to use force in perpetuity. And I could not vote for something like that. First of all, Congress has the responsibility to declare a war, give the authorization to use force. And you can't do that by giving that authorization away at one time for any one part of the world. And this was so vague, it said the Congress authorizes the president to use force against any nation, organization, individual he or she deems necessary or connected to 9/11, period, dot, dot. Now, that was so broad, it didn't make any sense, and I've seen, and the country now has seen what that has led to.
Before I go on to what has happened since then, and probably history has vindicated your stance on this, but let's go back to that moment and try to stay in that moment of immediately after those 9/11 attacks in 2001. And you said that you felt angry and that we had to do something. So if not that resolution, if not a authorization for the use of military force right then, which is what in fact happened, then in your view, what should have happened? You said we should do something. So what was the something?
The something never was debated. I mean, this resolution was brought before us and we had a 1 hour debate. So we still don't know what the alternatives were. We didn't even know it was Afghanistan, Al Qaeda. The resolution did not even specifically say where the use of force should be, targeted. And so the use of force was one option that may or may not have been the correct option, but it certainly wasn't the only option. And our Pentagon officials and the Defense Department should have been able to present a variety of options, a comprehensive strategy to be able to address the terrible terrorist attacks without leading into more war and into more anger and into more hostilities. And that's exactly what happened. So we don't know what those alternatives were. And we don't even know to this day if they would or would not work. What I was saying is that we should not authorize the use of force without looking at the array of strategies to use. And that's what happened.
If there had been a comprehensive discussion, what do you think would have happened? Would we have maybe gone into Afghanistan, for example, but not Iraq?
Maybe. Who knows? But we didn't have that debate. We didn't have that discussion. It was a one-hour debate, I'm telling you. We may have gone into Afghanistan in a very targeted, limited fashion to address al-Qaeda. We certainly did not need to go into Iraq. There were no weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. And this resolution in 2001 served as the basis for the Iraq resolution in 2002. And so what I said then and what I still say is that there could have been a variety of alternatives presented, debated, and then Congress could have done its job in terms of an appropriate response for the horrific attacks that took place.
What kind of a reaction did you receive? If there had maybe been some other people who had voted, other members of Congress who had voted against this, the light might not have shone as brightly on you, but I would imagine that you stood out as this one dissenting voice. So what was the reaction that you got, not only from people in your district in California, in the Bay Area, but also in other parts of the country?
The reaction was, for the most part, very hostile, very angry, death threats for months.
Death threats.
And, oh, yeah, death threats and a lot of security issues that I can't even talk about to this day that happened as a result. I had security for months. I couldn't go certain places. I had to travel with security. It was a very angry time, and people saw me as a target and called me a traitor. Of course, opposition in my elections happened. I had an opponent. She went to New York and walked with, I believe it was Mayor Giuliani, in a parade with a sign that said Barbara Lee hates America, with the World Trade Towers burning in the background and my smiling, and put that up on her website. So there was a lot of nasty and hostile attacks. But also, on the other hand, there were people who were very supportive from around the world. I received notes and meetings from Coretta Scott King, from Bishop Tutu, from 60,000. I had 60,000 emails and letters and phone calls, which are housed now at Mills College, my alma mater in Oakland. And at one day, I'm going to go out there and kind of read through all of these. I would say, from what I remember in terms of the percentage, it seems like there were probably maybe 40% positive and 60% very negative. And
60%.
Yeah.
So the majority. How did it feel to be, you're a patriot, you're serving your country as a member of Congress, and people are coming at you and calling you a traitor? These are not simply disagreeing opinions. These are personal attacks. I imagine it had to be hurtful.
It was very painful. It was horrible. But let me tell you, my dad was the first person who called me, and he was a retired lieutenant colonel. I'm a military brat, 25 years in the Army. My dad called me as I was walking back from the floor by myself to my office, and he said, "You did the right thing. There's no way we should send our troops into harm's way without knowing what we're doing and understanding the costs and the consequences." My father, military officer, very patriotic, served in two wars. Mind you, called me and told me that was the right thing. My family and my district, after 3 weeks, there were 3,000 people who came to downtown Oakland. Danny Glover, Alice Walker, many phenomenal leaders who came down and had a rally and said, "Yeah, that was the right vote. Just stand strong." You know, so all of that helped me and my faith. I'm a person of faith. And, you know, there's certain scriptures in Ephesians, for instance, you just stand while all hell is breaking out, you just stand. And so I had to draw on my family, friends, and my faith to really get me through that point. But it was very hard. But that doesn't mean, you know, people have those moments in life when they have to do the right thing and just kind of suffer the consequences.
Was this a time in our country where, you know, it happens from time to time in America where we seem to not be willing to listen as well as we do sometimes? Was this a time where voices of reason dissenting voices simply for whatever reason were not going to be tolerated?
What amazed me and shocked me, Paul, was that people really don't know, a lot of people don't know, that dissent is the essence of our democracy. I mean, it was like, why didn't you go along with the president and the Congress? Why do you have to be different? Why did you have to say no? It's like, you're a traitor. You know, and some of the reaction, I can't even talk about it, it was so bad. And it was really revealing to me that many people in our country don't really understand what democracy is all about. Peace is patriotic, first of all. Secondly, democracy is dissent is central to our democracy. And so I was very surprised that a lot of people in this country didn't really understand that, even in a time of national security crisis. And the second thing is, we're elected to Congress to try to sort all of this out, to be rational. Now, I'm a psychiatric social worker by profession, and psychology 101 says you don't make critical decisions in the moment of emotion and in the moment of fear and in the moment of anger, you know, because you just can't make the correct decision. Members of Congress are elected to be rational, to be thoughtful, and to lead, not mirror the anger that's out there, especially in times of crises. And what shocked me was that even people who thought that their members of Congress should lead still wanted them to follow. And we have the kind of information and the intelligence and what we need to know to make decisions that may be hard to make and very difficult to make, and sooner, and we have to educate the public about why we made those decisions. And so that was a very interesting moment for me to realize that in times of national security threats and crises, you know, oftentimes we go with the flow rather than saying we've got to not go with the flow, say, hold up. And I said this on the floor, let's hold up. Let's have a debate. Let's talk about the options. Let's be rational. Let's respond appropriately. That's all I was saying. And it was like, no, 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 no. We've got to get it. We've got to respond. We got to be with the president. The country's got to be unified. I said, well, listen, I'm as much of an American as you are. I'm as patriotic as you are. And I want to respond, but it's got to be appropriately where it doesn't create more war, more havoc, and more anger. And this resolution to this day is being used for more anger, more havoc, and more war. And we need to repeal it.
And it's interesting because if he was alive, President Eisenhower probably would have appreciated what you did, because he was the president who, on his way out of office, famously talked about and warned against the proliferation of the military-industrial complex. And then, of course, there's that famous saying that Benjamin Franklin had about those that would sacrifice liberty for security deserve neither liberty or security. So as history has played out, we've seen the situation drag out in Iraq. Afghanistan is looking, I hate to say Vietnam, but I don't know what else it looks like. We're bogged down. We don't seem to be getting anywhere there. So do you, as you look at all of the way that it has played out, do you feel vindicated now?
You know, it's not about feeling vindicated. It's about trying to figure out how to help us get out of this mess. And so I'm working now with my colleagues to try to repeal those authorizations. And I'm building quite a bit of support. I always offer an amendment to repeal the 2001 and 2002 authorization. And I believe the last time I offered the amendment to the Defense Appropriations and Defense Authorization Act, oh, I got about maybe 150, 160 votes. Now, that's a heck of a lot better than one. And so what I'm trying to do and is build bipartisan support to repeal these resolutions, one. Secondly, I've led in a letter to the speaker to have a debate and an authorization regarding these new wars that we're in. I mean, you look at Syria and you look at where we are around the world. I mean, come on, we need to debate this. We have a job as members of Congress, and it's our constitutional responsibility to authorize or declare war. We haven't done that. And so we need to repeal those two. We have to have a debate and an authorization for, and we can debate it. We can decide yes or no. Do we want the use of force to continue in Syria now? Do we want the use of force to be part of our foreign policy? But people have a right to have their, and they have a right and the duty to make their members of Congress vote on these grave matters.
Did anybody inside or outside of Congress circle back to you at some point and say, Barbara, you were right? And maybe not about exactly the stance that you took, but to have at least said, we need to debate this before we act.
Sure, many members to this day. And in fact, when you, again, looking at where we are now and today, my votes in terms of 150, 160 votes really show that members really believe that. We recently, and I'll get you a copy of the letter, I think we had 30 signatures, bipartisan, going to the speaker saying, let's have this debate. Hmm. So we have, I believe, close to a critical mass in Congress to do this.
It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer, and we are talking with this year's Thomas Merton Award winner, Congresswoman Barbara Lee of California. She is in Pittsburgh to accept the award this evening at the Sheridan Square Hotel and is with us in studio. She, again, was famous for casting the lone vote against authorization of force following the September 11th attacks. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can reach us at 412-246-2002. That's 412-246-2002. Email ESSPGH at WESA.FM and on Twitter at ESSPGH. Let's go to David, who is in the car driving to Washington, D.C. David, thank you for joining us. Please be careful.
Hi, thank you so much for taking my call. I'm just on my way back to D.C. And first of all, congratulations, Congresswoman, on your award. And also, I just wanted to say thank you so much for your vote that was against the use of force. But so you sort of asked my question, but I wanted to basically ask, because I think this is so important, because I do a lot of traveling. My grandfather was born in Iran, so I've spent some time in Iran, and a lot of the people there, they love Americans, but they hate the government. They think that our government is just always meddling in the affairs of, you know, our military and everything. So I just really want to thank you for just sort of doing anything you can. But I wanted to ask you, were there any congressmen or congresswomen who were thinking about maybe voting against it? Like I said, there are many thoughtful congressmen and congresswomen. So wasn't there someone who maybe was thinking about voting against the resolution as well? Just I'll hang up and let you talk.
That's an interesting point, David.
Yeah, if you go back and look at the debate, many members who had a chance to get down there for that hour said much of what I was saying. I think, you know, when you cast that vote, though, that's a different issue. I think during our Democratic caucus meetings, I heard a lot of reluctance. We had to negotiate even a broader resolution down to this. And I think that there were several members who wanted to vote no. And publicly, Congressman John Lewis told me, I mean, and he told the press, the Washington Post, he wished he had. You know, he was very forthright, very candid, and very honest in his response. And he said it publicly. Many members told me privately. But if you read the congressional record that day, you will see and hear some of the arguments that would lead you to believe that people were, and members were. But you got to remember, members of Congress are human beings. They're people who are struggling through all of this also. And it was that moment that was so terrible and so tragic that overwhelmed everybody, I believe. No one knew what to do. And, you know, that's fair.
There are people who think that things like the Patriot Act and expansion of the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, that was the real collateral damage of 9/11. What do you think?
That came probably later. Well, that was later. And I remember there were probably 66 votes against the Patriot Act. You know, we have to have that balance between civil liberties and national security. And there had been a Patriot Act that, it wasn't called that, but FISA Reauthorization Patriot Act that had been negotiated. And the night before it was to come to the floor, it was completely rewritten and came to the floor the next day. No one even had a chance to read it. It was a new bill. It was not the bill that came out of the committee. And so this was a terrible bill. And yes, it has led, this is part of why we are where we are today, not the entire policy, but we have to worry a little bit about this whole national security state that we're in. I remember the days of COINTELPRO, for example. I was very involved as a community member, not a party member, but I was involved with the Black Panther Party, and I was a target of COINTELPRO. I understand the wiretapping and how that net could be so broad that you can catch people and create witch hunts and do things that are really unconstitutional. And so I'm very careful as it relates to our privacy and national security. We have to have that balance, and I don't think we did that in the Patriot Act right after 9/11.
Were you in agreement with President Obama taking out Osama bin Laden in 2011?
The way it happened? No one knew that this was taking place. I mean, the Pentagon, and that, you know, he accomplished the goal. The Pentagon did it. I mean, I don't know what all the options had been, but that was done. And he, and at least we didn't lose any of our brave men and women who were involved in the operation. And I think most people agree that it had to be done, and he did it in a way that saved lives.
And what do you think of the way that the president, President Obama, has handled not just Iraq and Afghanistan, but also Libya? We went into Libya. We kind of had a false start going into Syria, and now we seem to be there, sort of. As you, if you don't mind me pointing out that you're rolling your eyes as I say that. So how would you assess how he has handled these things?
Well, first, let me just say this president has handled foreign policy in a different way, I think, in a much more reasonable manner than the Bush administration. He has established the diplomatic initiatives and negotiations and political settlements should be a priority. I did not agree with Libya. You look at what has happened now. There was no plan for after Libya. I did not agree with, you know, the use of force almost on the chemical weapons in Syria. And I led the effort to ask the president to look at alternatives. There were several of us, and we went to the White House, talked, and we negotiated kind of a new strategy, and that worked. I mean, you know, the chemical weapons with Russia's, you know, support and leadership, and this president working on that, you know, the chemical weapons that had been so devastating are no longer in Syria. I think that was a major accomplishment. But I don't agree with, you know, I didn't vote for the funding to send over to Syria for training the, quote, moderate opposition. And you see about a month ago that funding was stopped. We don't know who it went to and who it was going to. So I didn't support that. But I think that this president is trying to find ways to try to help solve the crises in the Middle East without the use of ground troops. I worry, though, now with Afghanistan and with sending more troops there, and this war should have ended. Iraq should have ended, but we're still there in both countries. And so we need to come up with a strategy, I think, that really de-emphasizes the military role of the United States, that allows for more of a leadership role of the Afghan people, of the Iraqi people, in terms of our support for their development and support for what they're doing, rather than be involved in the military operations as we are. So
the argument, though, against that is that people point out that, and it's hard to argue with this, that in Afghanistan in particular, it doesn't look as though people there are ready to take a leadership role.
Well, 14 years ago, I mean, we've been there for 14 years in a military capacity. Has it worked? I mean, we're still there. We should be away from Afghanistan. Are we going to stay there forever in perpetuity? Are we going to continue to use taxpayer dollars that could be funding jobs, transportation, schools here in our own country? Are we going to continue to do this in Afghanistan? We've got to do it differently. I'm not an isolationist. But I'm saying we need to really de-emphasize our military presence there and make the Afghans step up and do it themselves with our support. But continuing to send more troops, more advisors, one, puts our young men and women, and they've done everything we've asked them to do. It puts them once again in harm's way. Secondly, 14 more years, where are we going to be if we don't, you know, come up with a new strategy?
It's Essential Pittsburgh. Our guest is California Congresswoman Barbara Lee. She's in Pittsburgh to accept this year's Thomas Merton Award. We will spend more time with her. We'll get to your emails, your calls at 412-246-2002. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. This is Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA. It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer, and we're continuing with our guest, California Congresswoman Barbara Lee. She is receiving the Thomas Merton Center Award tonight for courage in standing as a lone voice for human rights and human dignity. She was the lone dissenting vote in the authorization of force by Congress following the September 11th attacks. You can join the conversation at 412-246-2002. That's 412-246-2002. I do want to mention Barbara Lee's written a book called Renegade for Peace and Justice. And you can also email us at esspgh@wesa.fm, on Twitter at esspgh. Rachel, in an email, says, I heard Barbara Lee speak on Radiolab. I was moved by the quotation the Congresswoman reflected upon while making the difficult decision to stand alone. Let us not become the evil we deplore. I think of this profound statement in moments of anger and or hurt when impulses to retaliate arise. I am wondering if Barbara Lee can discuss her thoughts about this concept and how to balance needs for safety and self-respect. So I'll let you respond to thank you for that email, Rachel.
Thank you. Well, you know, I went to the memorial service for the victims of 9/11, and I almost didn't go to the memorial service. It was at the National Cathedral. Something at the last minute, though, because I wanted to
stay. Why didn't you want to go?
I didn't want to go because I knew this resolution was coming up, and I had to sort through all of the issues and try to figure out what to do and how I was going to say what I had to say. So I was going to stay there. And something at the last minute told me, go on to the memorial service. I went to the memorial service, and of course George Bush and the president and others spoke, but the pastor of the National Cathedral, I think his name was Nathan Baxter, in his memorial and in his eulogy, he said something to the effect, let us not become the evil we deplore, which we deplore. And so I noted that on the program, and so I quoted him, or paraphrase what he said in my speech on the floor when I said I was going to vote no. And that was a very powerful moment for me because that was when I knew I was very settled, knowing what the response would be if I were going to be the only one. I thought maybe a couple more members were going to vote no, but, you know. And so, but when he said that and when I prayed and when I left that cathedral, I was very settled with whatever. I said, let the chips fall where they may. I know I have to vote no because this is the right vote to cast because, you know, for all the reasons we discussed earlier. And so I'm glad people are listening to that and remembering that because that's a very powerful principle that we need to use in our personal lives and in our public lives, whatever we're doing. And also, let me just go back to this president as it relates to his foreign policy. Another example of how President Obama is trying to look at a way to explore non-military options is through the Iran deal. And that was a really hard deal for him to negotiate. This administration worked very hard on that. I introduced legislation probably 5 or 6 years ago calling for a diplomatic track as it relates to the Iran issue as it relates to nuclear weapons. I think it was called Keeping Iran from Acquiring a Nuclear Weapon. I mean, I wanted the language really plain. Secondly, it called for the end of the no-contact policy. Third, it called for a special envoy and to develop a diplomatic trap. I introduced that resolution to give the space on Capitol Hill for members of Congress to begin to debate what a diplomatic initiative would look like. Didn't get a lot of co-sponsors, maybe 10, 15, but at least we had hearings. I was able to try to amend legislation calling for a diplomatic initiative as it relates to non-proliferation of nuclear weapons in Iran. And so this president really, I think, worked very hard, did everything right to try to, you know, rid Iran from nuclear proliferation, but also trying to build some consensus around how we move forward in achieving global peace and security in the region. So that's just another example of why, how I think this administration has shifted course, really, in terms of a new foreign policy, but still, you know, in certain parts of the world, such as in Libya and Syria, and we have to really be very careful about what we're doing there now.
The president of the University of Missouri System resigned today amid criticism of his handling of student complaints about race and discrimination. What is your reaction to this development? What do you make of the situation at the University of Missouri? And in your opinion, do racist policies exist at some major universities?
Well, he should have resigned. That was the right thing to do. It is really quite pathetic that here in 2015, we're still dealing with racism the way we are. I have to look at my own district. Last week, Berkeley High School, there were racist emails by someone as it relates to African Americans at Berkeley High School. The young people, I was so amazed and proud of them. They all walked off campus. White, African American, Latino, Asian Pacific American, 1,500 students marched down and peacefully in the city of Berkeley. And so we have this all over the country that we must deal with, whether they're racist policies that are written in stone or institutional racism that comes as a result of sometimes conscious, sometimes unconscious biases. It permeates American society everywhere. And that's why in my district, every couple of months, I hold forums on racial justice and race, because we need to really begin to talk about how race is a factor in every aspect of American life and try to come up with ways to, first of all, deal with incidents like this and prevent them from happening. But secondly, what are the policies and institutional biases that allow for this kind of behavior to take place? And so institutional racism is embedded in so many institutions in America. We've got to sweep it from under the rug, and we've got to understand that even 50 years after the passage of the Voting Rights Act and the Civil Rights Act, the Higher Ed Act, this is the 50th anniversary of the War on Poverty and the Civil Rights Movement, Selma to Montgomery. We still have a lot of work to do when it comes to racial justice in our country. And it begins by talking about it, yes, but it also means we have to look at every institution in America and where we have criminal justice policies that negatively impact African American and Latino men, where we have educational policies that create even a wider gap, achievement gap, whether you have healthcare statistics, when you look at the dismal healthcare disparities in communities of color, where you look at housing, when you look at unemployment rates, you can look at every aspect of American society, and you will see a racial component. And so we have to deal with that. And I think that what happened in Missouri is terrible. It's unfortunate. It's devastating, really, in many ways. But he did the right thing by resigning. But hopefully they'll use that moment now, and we will use it throughout the country to figure out what is underlying all of this and how to stop it from happening. Because this is America, and everyone deserves to be treated with dignity, with respect, and our institutions and our public policies should provide for that.
Congresswoman Barbara Lee is our guest, and I wish we had more time. We're down to just a couple of minutes, but I really wanted to ask you about, while you were a college student, you were a volunteer at the Oakland chapter of the Black Panther Party's Community Learning Center. What was that experience like?
It was a great experience in spite of the FBI and J. Edgar Hoover. I was able to work with Bobby Seale and Huey Newton and Elaine Brown and Erica Huggins and all the great leaders. And this was a part of the civil rights movement, mind you. This had to do with, initially, police misconduct, you know, and what was happening in terms of police brutality in African-American neighborhoods. But then the Black Panther Party started the 10-point program, feeding kids breakfast. I mean, the free breakfast program for children started with the Black Panther Party. And so it was a visionary party. Education, health care, you know, all of the basics that people deserve, whether you're Black, whether you're poor, whoever you are. And it was not a nationalist party. The Black Panther Party was supported by white progressives, by Asian Pacific Americans, Latinos. It was a multicultural party. And so I actually helped start the school. I raised the money, formed the corporation. I did a lot of the work to put together the Community Learning Center. I was Bobby Seale's fundraising coordinator when he ran for mayor of Oakland. There's no way we would have had our first African-American mayor in Oakland had it not been for the Black Panther Party. Bobby Seale got into the runoff. We registered people. I learned how to register people block by block by block. And it was at that point also that I was working with Shirley Chisholm. I was a student, and I registered to vote, and I worked with the Panthers to get the Panthers involved in voter registration efforts, and they ended up supporting Shirley Chisholm for president.
Right, she ran and for so, president in 72.
72, yeah, and that's how I got involved in politics. And so working with the Panthers at a grassroots level and helping develop a political agenda that led to voter registration and the support of a presidential candidate for me was just quite phenomenal. And it's a lesson that I hope young people can learn today in terms of how the Black Panthers maintained their community service through the 10-point programs, but understood that if you were going to change the conditions that gave rise to poverty and to police misconduct, the conditions that gave rise to deplorable housing, that you had to change the system and you had to change public policy. And so you had to petition your government, as we are required to do, to make this a better country and a better world. And I think they really did that.
And eventually you went to Washington and you've been in Congress all these years. How is Congress different from when you first worked in Washington?
I worked for a great leader, Congressman Ron Dellums. First of all, I was an intern for Ron in the 70s during Watergate and then came back and headed up his office. And so I was there as a staffer when Tip O'Neill was speaker and when Jimmy Carter was president. I saw Nixon's helicopter take off during impeachment. And so I've been in Washington during different periods. And it's a very interesting place to be there now as a member since 98. And I have seen the bipartisan spirit erode. We're trying to work on that, but it's a place where you come and you work hard. I mean, we work day and night, and then you leave and go back home and work in your district on the weekend, and you come back, work day and night in D.C., then you go back and work in your district on the weekend. So you don't have a chance, like in the old days and in the day, where members got a chance to be with each other and to be with their families and get to know each other. And that's probably the biggest, I would say the biggest difference that I see from when I was a staffer to now, because it is a very, very busy, very intense pace.
Would it help if congressmen and women didn't have to run every 2 years?
I personally would like every 4 to 6 years, but that would require some constitutional changes. Every 2 years, the money, I mean, when you look at Citizens United and corporate money and money that's undisclosed, this fundraising every 2 years, you've got to do this constantly. So we've got to get to public financing of campaigns. We've got to overturn Citizens United, because otherwise, you know, our democracy is at stake. I really believe that with all of this money coming in, this corporate money that is unknown, undisclosed, and the Supreme Court said corporations are people. I mean, come on. So they think they have the same rights as individuals have. This is outrageous. And so we've got to get money out of politics.
Congresswoman Barbara Lee has been our guest. She represents the Bay Area of California, the 13th District. And she's in Pittsburgh tonight to receive the Thomas Merton Award. It'll happen at the Sheraton Hotel at Station Square this evening between 6 and 9 o'clock. And I've really enjoyed having you as
Thank
my
you.
Guest.
And let me just say how humbled I am to be here and to receive this award. The Thomas Merton Center, I mean, they do phenomenal work. It's probably, as I learned this morning, one of the oldest peace and justice organizations in the country. And so I know everyone is very proud, and I hope that everyone is supporting the Thomas Merton Center. And also, Congressman Mike Doyle is my friend and colleague, and he's been telling me about the Thomas Merton Center for quite a while. He's very proud of what is taking place there. So I just have to say and give a shout out to Congressman Doyle, and he is absolutely correct about the center.
Congresswoman Barbara Lee has been our guest. Thank you again so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Coming up, marking the anniversary of the fall of the Berlin Wall, it's Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA.